I really think that the Taku watershed is really an opportunity to do things different. We're really fortunate in that the Taku is a salmon stronghold. And a big part of the reason for that is that there's a bunch of it now is protected thanks to the hard work of the Taku River Tlunkit people. There's a pretty good extensive network of protected areas. So we have really good habitat. The Taku is virtually roadless. We have decent numbers of salmon, relatively speaking. And I really think we have an opportunity to do things different, putting wild salmon first and maintaining that habitat. And I think it's very much so because the Taku River Tlunkit have fought like hell to kind of protect it and to make it that way. And the world is going to owe kind of a debt of gratitude to the Taku River Tlunkit people for doing that. Mm-hmm. And I think that as time goes on, that's going to become more and more obvious as things progress here.
From the Northern Confluence Initiative, this is 54 Degrees North. Northern Confluence is dedicated to conserving the salmon watersheds that sustain our communities, economies, and shared futures.
Hi, I'm Nikki Skuse. Welcome to my podcast, 54 Degrees North. As part of our podcast series on salmon connections and resilience, we head further north to Taku River Tlingit territory, where the stewardship of the Indigenous peoples continues to ensure that it's a salmon stronghold. We will hear about some of the initiatives they're doing and collaborative research being undertaken towards salmon resilience in this era of climate change. First, we talk with Mark Connor, the fisheries coordinator for the TRT First Nation, and then we catch up with Chris Sargent, researcher with the Flathead Biological Station, who is assisting with some of the collaborative research in the Taku region.
Good morning, Nikki. Yeah, I'm Mark Connor. I'm the fisheries coordinator for the Taku River Tlingit First Nation based up here in Atlin, British Columbia.
Great. And what got you interested in salmon?
Well, I mean, I've always had a passion for wild places and wildlife. And quite a number of years ago, I had an opportunity to gain employment with the Taku River Tlingit First Nation. I was living up here on the Yukon side of within their traditional territory, and a job opportunity came up. It was through the Habitat Conservation and Stewardship Program that Fisheries and Oceans had established back then. That was the late 90s. And, you know, I kind of was checking into it, and I looked at a map at the Taku River and the Atlin area, and I just kind of went, wow, you know, this could be my study area. So yeah, I jumped on it, and I was fortunate enough to get the job. And so yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, I kind of like to think of it like it was kind of the land that called me here, you know. Mm-hmm. Like I looked at the map, like I said, and yeah, so in many ways it was kind of like the land that called me here. And yeah, that was 23 years ago, and I kind of haven't looked back since.
Some regions this year have had really strong salmon returns, and others, we've seen crazy devastation from droughts. And then I know I just read an article about really, really low numbers of Chinook in the Yukon River. I'm just wondering, how were the salmon returns in Taku River Tlingit territory this year?
Yeah, it's been a bit of a mixed bag. I'd say we're doing better than most places in BC, from my understanding, but it really varies by the species. Chinook are not looking good, and are below average again. And that's been for a number of years now. They were forecasted to come in around 6,600 was the forecast. Maybe we did a little better than that. The recent 10-year average for Chinook is 15,000. Okay. But even that 10-year average is less than the lower end of our escapement goal, which is like 19,000 to 36,000 for the Taku. So yeah, Chinook are not doing good. It's not just the Taku, as I'm sure you know. It's pretty much a regional issue. something going on with Chinook. So they didn't do well. Sockeye is a different story. They did quite well in the TACU this year. The final numbers aren't in, but we're looking at an escapement of probably around 100,000 sockeye. So that's well above average, which the 10-year average is about 73,000. And it's well above our escapement goal range, which is between 40 and 75,000 for wild fish. So sockeye did well. So that was great. Coho, a bit below the average. And again, we don't have the final numbers, but we're looking at about 65,000. And I think the 10-year average is 73. So yeah, Chinook, not good. Sockeye, good. Coho, not great, but not a crisis. We also have pink and chum in the TACU. We don't get final numbers on those. Pink are odd year dominant, as I'm sure you know, they kind of spike every other year. So pink are odd year dominant. So it wasn't a big year for pinks. 2020, we had a massive pink run. Some of us were actually down at Canoe Landing in one area, and there were so many carcasses. You're literally slipping and sliding all over the rocks with pinks. And chum, we don't really have good numbers on chum. But yeah, so basically kind of a mixed bag all around, but overall probably better than most areas in BC, I would think.
For listeners who might not understand what escapement goals are, could you just explain what that refers to?
Yeah, escapement goals refer to the number of fish that fisheries managers target to get onto the spawning grounds.
Right.
That's your goal. That's what we manage for, to try to get that many fish onto the spawning grounds.
Right. And so, and sort of until you reach that goal too, you're limiting, there's limits to harvest.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a combination in the TACU. We do in-season abundance estimates.
Right.
So they do a mark recapture program. So they put tags on fish down at the U.S. border, Canyon Island, they call it. And then based on the number of tags that they recover in the commercial fishery and some of the other management, they come up with weekly estimates of how many fish are in the river. And then they gauge how long what they call an opening is. So how long commercial fishers are allowed to fish. And that those openings are based on, weekly estimates of how many fish are in the river. So yeah, the management regime is pretty, fairly thorough in that regard. Particularly for sockeye, which is the main, commercial species on the TACU.
Yeah.
We haven't had any commercial fishing or any recreational fishing for shrimp now for a number of years because of conservation concerns.
Right. And how would you say that salmon habitat, quantity and quality is changing in BC's Northwest, or more specifically there in the TACU River Tlingit territory?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things happening that we're seeing. Glacial retreat is one that's fairly obvious. It seems to be happening quite rapidly. Well, it is happening quite rapidly, and we're looking at that to see, how that's affecting salmon habitat. It looks like in some areas, for sure, it's actually increasing salmon habitat. So fast glacial retreat isn't a good thing, but it does look like there could be some benefits. Well, almost assuredly, there are going to be some benefits for salmon there. The other interesting thing we're seeing, water levels are kind of all over the place, really. We had a couple of years where it was really, really low water levels, and that was causing some challenges. And then, the year before last, we had very, very high water levels. So it's kind of bouncing all over the place. And that's causing challenges. And one of the areas it's causing challenges is access issues for salmon. And I'll give you one example in particular. We have one of the four main sockeye spawning lakes in the TACU is Kuthai Lake. And that lake is accessed along the Silver Salmon River. And the lower end of the Silver Salmon River, there's a series of potential barriers like waterfalls. You know, it's a pretty steep kind of cascade with, there's about 8 waterfalls in there that are, you know, between a meter and 2 meter, I mean, not quite 2 meters high. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always been a challenge for the fish, and they've actually adapted in, you know, morphologically to actually and run timing wise to deal with that. But when you start getting water levels all over the map, it can really mess with that. And we've been doing work in that canyon now for several years, initially because it low water issues at one point were causing challenges. We thought we had the problem solved. And then, boom, we got into a really high water, a couple of years of really high water, and that caused a different set of challenges, and we're dealing with that as well. So water levels, like I said, water levels, big issue. Barriers are coming, and barriers are one way that those challenges are kind of expressing themselves. We've also been doing some work looking at water temperatures, and in a few spots, it's kind of surprising how warm, you know, we're quite far up north here. And I, for one, was actually fairly surprised at how warm some of those lakes were actually getting. So that's starting to play out. And then the other thing that I think we're going to see, we haven't seen it for the last couple of years because it's been fairly wet up here the last couple of summers. But in those dry years, we can see some pretty large forest fires. Mm-hmm. And those, of course, can have impacts to salmon habitat, you know, associated landslides. You get debris into the river and sediment and large woody debris, which is often good, but it can kind of hang up on in certain areas. And what we found in one area, for example, getting back to the barrier issue, you know, log jams are generally not a challenge for salmon. But sometimes when you get them in association with kind of bedrock constrictions in the river, for example, that those can cause us some challenge. So, yeah, you know, glacial retreat, water levels, barriers, some warming in some areas, and then potentially forest fires are some of the things that we're seeing in the Taku here.
And what are the Taku River Tlingit First Nation doing to help support salmon resilience given these changes?
Well, we're doing a number of things. As I kind of alluded to before, we have a couple of projects in two systems where we're looking at remediation of barriers. And they're not full barriers, but they're kind of obstacles, depending on water level and so on and debris. A project that's been running for about 4 or 5 years now, kind of picking away at a couple of those barriers. One in particular, it's a challenging area to work. You have to rappel 90 feet down into a canyon.
Oh wow!
we don't want to do any blasting in there because the rock is really fractured and you're down in a canyon. And the last thing we want to do is make things worse. You know, we don't want to start blowing stuff up and then have the whole canyon come down on us. So it's taking some time. And also, as I alluded to before, it used to be a low water issue, and now we're into a high water issue. Mm-hmm. So our strategies have had to adjust to that a little bit. The other thing we're doing in terms of salmon resilience is, we have some collaborative research projects, some partners that we're working with to basically look at some bigger issues around, you know, how climate change is expressing itself. We're dividing out the Taku into a number of sub-watersheds. And then based on those sub-watersheds, we're doing like a vulnerability assessments. So we're looking at the watersheds and there's a number of metrics we're looking at, things like, area of glacier within that watershed. How many lakes are connected to that system, how many wetlands, what is the slope, the topography, distance from tidewater, all those kind of things, looking at those metrics and trying to get a sense of which of those watersheds are going to be most vulnerable to climate change, how that climate change is going to express itself, and I guess most importantly, like, what are we going to do about it,
right?
You know, which is hopefully to flow. And, you know, we're just kind of in the stages of working at through that project right now. So We're in a really remote area up in the Taku here, and not a lot of information modeling. There's not a lot of site-specific data to feed into models. So we're trying to help get that information. And then the other thing that we're doing, and I think it's really important, is basically helping to kind of revitalize and invigorate, I guess, people connecting to the landscape. You know, like I said, Taku is a challenging place to get into, even for the clean people who live up here. It's an expensive and challenging place to get into. And so trying to really help facilitate that and kind of build on those relationships that people have with their land and with the salmon, and trying to, you know, bolster that and support that. And along with that, we've been talking quite a bit about building these kind of knowledge hubs within the watershed. And these would be areas where we can bring Tlingit people and scientists together in a mainly informal format, I guess, to just basically, so Tlingit people could be commercial fishing, scientists would be there, and basically, you know, an exchange of information, cross-pollinization, I guess you could say. And so we're looking, again, early stages, but we're looking at building these knowledge hubs as areas to bring people together to serve as a kind of a basis for research and things like that. Those are some of the things we're doing for salmon resilience.
That sounds great. And I love the idea of really, you know, I think we've talked about this here in the Skeena region, that the challenge sometimes when there are low numbers of salmon is that just then there's a further disconnect because people aren't getting out and aren't able to, you know, process, or, you know, salmon is kind of a unifier in terms of helping do what we can to sort of protect the watershed. And, but, you know, if people aren't getting out and being reminded of what that value is or whatever, it makes it sort of more and more challenging.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a kind of a insidious feedback loop that starts happening where people can't fish, so they lose that connection, and the amount of dedication that you need to kind of deal with stuff is harder to generate because people are less connected potentially. Luckily in the Taku here, you know, as I was mentioning, although we have challenges with some species, one in particular, there are still salmon for people to access. Yeah. And so we can still build on that at this point. So we're really lucky in that way.
There's been shared some videos from the Taggart from you guys about this really amazing relationship that you have with grizzlies at the fish fence. So I'm just wondering if you can share a little bit more about that relationship and how it is to work alongside these bears.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I personally have been incredibly fortunate to be a part of that project. I took over from a fella named Phil Timpany, who ran that weir for years, and he's still very much involved in grizzly bear conservation. What it is there's a carcass weir, so essentially a fence set up across the river downstream of a spawning area, a Chinook spawning area. And then when those Chinook die, the carcasses float up against the weir, and then we sample them for those carcasses for age, sex, and length.
Okay.
And Taku's a wild place, and there's lots of grizzlies in that area. So the grizzly bears key into those carcasses. What Phil found when he was working there, and he ran that weir for 20 years before I took it over, and I've been there for 20 years now as well. What Phil found was that if you try to run those bears off, they basically just come back at night, and then they end up wrecking the weir and so on. And so so it made more sense basically to coexist with those bears and allow them to be there when you're there, as long as they don't wreck the weir. You know, right. Bears are really smart, and they do learn what's acceptable, and they're very they, especially around salmon, they're like this with each other. They're very open to you know, forms of communication in terms of what's okay and what's not. and they're incredibly smart animals. And so over the years, over the decades, there's been a number of bears in particular that we have established a really strong coexistence relationship with. There are bears there now where it's, you know, we know that bear, we know that bear's mother, we know that bear's grandmother.
Right.
And Phil knows that bear's great, knew that bear's great kind of thing. And those bears come back, they bring their cubs. It's mainly females, and they'll bring their cubs to the weir, and then the cubs learn what the program is. A big part of the reason why this has been successful is because because the Taku River Tlingit people have have a very high regard and respect for grizzly bears. I really think that's kind of one of the core basis as to why this has gone the way it has. But one thing I do want to say, because, you know, and I don't know if this comes out in that video or not, we do have some really, really close relationships with those bears, and in some cases, some really, really close encounters with bears. But I think it's important to understand that we don't do that with every bear. Like I let some bears come very, very close to me if I know who it is. If right. I know the context, if I know the context and I know the bear, then sometimes we have really, really close encounters. But right. if I don't know the bear, or even if it's a bear I know, but it's a totally different context, I don't necessarily let that occur. We don't let that occur.
Yeah.
So I think.
Yeah. And I think it comes like, I think you've mentioned a couple of times, sort of like a coexistence. So it's not like you guys aren't, it's not like zoo animals or something where you're like petting them and feeding them. You're just like creating very clear sort of guidelines around this weir of, you know, hey, we're working here, back off, yeah. you know, yeah. or hey, here, you know, go take your little, you know, you can hang out over there and eat the carcasses while we're working. But like, yeah, like you sort of have that. It's a very different, a sort of mutual respect kind of thing, but sort of setting, I guess, those clear boundaries.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard some people refer to it as a social contract.
Okay.
There's rules to the game.
Yeah.
And a big part of those rules for us as the people who work there is respect. You got to respect that bear. It's cool. And I've been really incredibly privileged to be a part of that, for sure.
Yeah, that's amazing. In terms of thinking about the salmon, and you've talked a lot about the varying sort of climate impacts and collaborative research, where do you, what are you sort of hopeful for potentially in the region around salmon and, you know, what worries you?
Well, in terms of like strategies, and so on going forward in terms of salmon management, specifically, one of the questions I've been struggling with a little bit here is around how are we adjusting or considering escapement goals in the face of climate change? Mm-hmm. And there are two kind of main things that I think of when I think of that. One is the issue around like colonizing areas after glaciers have retreated, you know, like, and that would depend on salmon straying from where they are currently spawning. So like, how does that process work? And do we need to be thinking about adjusting escapement goals? Do we need more salmon in the system mm-hmm. to make sure that we're feeding that opportunity for salmon to stray into these new habitats as they emerge, for example? So that's one thing. And then the other question I have is, climate change is happening. It's happening very rapidly. Climate change has happened in the past, but the rate of change now that is happening, as I understand it, is much quicker than it has happened in the past.
And especially in the north, like it's happening. Yeah. Like we're already over 1.6 degrees here in Smithers area. And so I imagine it's even a little bit more than that where you are.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, salmon and animals can adapt to change, of course, through evolution and so on. But it seems to me like, especially now, you know, we have commercial fishing, you know, kind of impacting these populations, and I'm guessing kind of reducing the gene pool. And I don't know this for a fact, but I want to phrase this as a question, is like, should we be looking at things like, do we need to be managing salmon so to ensure that we have a big enough gene pool to lend itself to that kind of adaptation as climate change happens? Maybe I'm just not part of the conversation, but I'd like to kind of get a better sense as to how is the way we're managing salmon adjusting to the reality of climate change? And those are just a couple of examples that I specific examples that of questions that I had.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Mark, and for all you do. I'm glad the land drew you out there.
Yeah, thanks, Nikki.
It's July 25th, 2022. We are at Silver Salmon Falls, the canyon, and watching sockeye salmon try to make it up a really steep section of the river. When you look down, you can see fish tagged. They're orange or pink, and they're all pooled up, and some of them are slapping against the rocks as they try to jump up.
My name is Chris Sargent. I'm a research scientist with the University of Montana's Flathead Lake Biological Station.
How are salmonid habitat quantity and habitat quality changing in BC's Northwest? Or, you know, more specifically, where you've just recently been in Taku River Tlingit territory?
Yeah, I think of Taku River Tlingit territory, southeastern Alaska, the panhandle that borders northwest BC, all of those areas are kind of undergoing the same kind of atmospheric changes, right? We expect to continue seeing warmer and wetter conditions. So, you know, summer and winter air temperatures are rising, glaciers are retreating, more precipitation's falling as rain in the winter. So those all have knock-on effects to the watersheds that salmon depend on. Expect to see more rain-fed systems that are usually getting more of their water from snow. So that means during the summer that if you have a very dry summer, we'll see some of the watersheds drying up, providing less water for salmon migration, for adults spawning, or for juveniles rearing and feeding. With glaciers retreating, that's kind of a mixed message story. There's some really interesting research, especially from John Moore's lab at Simon Fraser University. Kara Pittman, they've led a couple of studies about how retreating glaciers will create new salmon habitat in the future, and that's true in the Taku. One of our focal places is the Tulsiquot River, and that glacier's retreating really quickly. There's a new lake forming at the toe of the glacier. And that's doing a couple things. It's slowly warming the water up, which is good in the short term, salmon, because it's an ultra cold system. So now salmon, it's not optimal habitat, but it's getting better and better. And also it's maybe opening up new spawning habitat decades from now. So there's, in some places, the habitat's shrinking. And in other places, it's growing. It's a really diverse and dynamic place these days.
And I think that's what's so fascinating about the like kind of resilience or adaptation of salmon, because it seems to be, I mean, I've heard that in Gitignau territory too, that there's been with some glacial melt and receding, there's been, you know, more of an abundance of salmon going to a river system where they never were before because the water was too cold. So it's sort of a hopeful message, but then also a cautionary message, you know, like for, as you said, like how, you know, the sort of long-term projections. So I guess in terms of that, just what are the different sort of strategies that may need to happen and mitigation efforts to help ensure the resilience and adaptation of salmon?
Yeah, I think that's the million-dollar question, and there's a lot of different ways to answer. I mean, you know, broad scale, of course, we need to do things to curb climate change to the extent we can to preserve glaciers as long as we can. I'm less worried about places like the Tulsipo River, where the drainage might have, and, you know, 20 to 40% of the basin has ice in it. A place like that is probably going to keep becoming better salmon habitat over time, at least in the foreseeable future. But some of the other places where maybe there's only 3 or 4% of the watershed has glacier ice left in it, they're at a real crux where they might be very productive salmon habitat right now, but it's going to be changing rapidly. The water will be warming maybe to above optimal temperatures. And so there's an argument to make more precautionary harvest practices in watersheds where, you know, maybe salmon are going to be struggling more. Like, I hate, it's a horrible science word, stochasticity, right? It basically means like there's going to be more random stuff happening. Like there might be very, very good years for salmon in those watersheds and very, very bad years, depending on floods and drought. And so I think managers and people who care about abundant salmon harvests need to be more precautionary in those places and realize, well, you might have a bumper crop one year, but the next year could be a total wipeout because the stream channel dried up because it was, you know, hot for 3 weeks straight during the spawning window. So I think expecting more randomness, more extreme events, and being precautionary about that will be a really important theme for the future.
Right. And is that how, is that something that you do? Like, what's your process and approach sort of for assessing these climate and glacial retreat impacts on salmon and salmon habitat?
Yeah. Concentrating on the Tulsiqua again, where, you know, we have this great partnership. It's the University of Montana's Flathead Lake Biostation, who I work for, and Aaron Sexton. We're close colleagues. And then we work with Simon Fraser University, John Moore's lab, and Taku River Tlingit. And we're doing kind of a four-pronged approach to looking at salmon habitat in the Tulsiqua. We look at stream flow, water temperature, habitat changes, and then hopefully in the near future, where the fish are currently living in that system. And the way we do that is, you know, there's no directly measured stream flow from the Tulsiqua River. So we use models that help predict how stream flow might change as the glacier changes. We have water temperature sensors throughout the system to see what the current temperature is, and we can use models to predict future water temperature. And we can also, Diane Whited is one of our really talented colleagues at Flathead Biostation that we work with. She uses satellite imagery to see how the actual floodplain has changed in the Tulsiqua River over time. So whether the vegetation is becoming more dense, whether there's more or less groundwater channels, which salmon really like to spawn and rear in, whether there is more nodes or connections and channels, and kind of that is a surrogate for habitat complexity in the stream. So we can measure all those things with satellite imagery in lieu of having actual direct on the ground measurements. And what Diane's found is over just the past decade alone, as this new lake I mentioned is forming at the headwaters of Tulsiqua, it's buffering a lot of those flood events and extreme flows that come from the glacier melting. And so that's actually creating, you can see a signal in satellite imagery with more dense vegetation, which suggests the floodplain is moving around less. The cobble and the rocks are not as dynamic and active as they used to be. So plants can root and grow more densely, and that signals that maybe it's becoming a more stable, nice place for salmon to live and rear, as opposed to kind of fighting really cold temperatures and flooding all the time.
Oh, super interesting. Although, and there, I guess there's also the some risks, like we've seen in the Northwest and including in Taku River Tlingit territory with big landslides and that sort of thing happening.
Yeah. What was that? That was Christmas Eve, December 2020, a giant landslide on the main stem Taku covered up most of the channel. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but it was a really gigantic piece of mountain and effectively blocked the river temporarily. And I think the good news to that, well, the bad news first is that these things might become more common as permafrost thaws or things that, you know, heavier precipitation happens, which causes landslides. We might see more of these happening. The good news side of the story is that Taku is a big, strong river, and the landslide really, the timing of it was fairly good, and the river carved through it, and there doesn't appear to be any kind of migrational challenges for upstream migrating sockeye or any of the salmon species. So it definitely rearranged the floodplain a bit, but it doesn't look like it's going to be long-term detrimental to salmon in the river.
Right. Okay, good. Do you want to share a little bit more about what you've learned during your time up in the Taku and with the Taku River Tlingit?
Wow. Yeah. This has been working in Taku with TRT has been just a real highlight of my career. My first time there, I landed on a helicopter on the floodplain Tulsaqua River and stepped out, and I've been on a lot of rivers. And I was just struck immediately by the uniqueness and breadth and vastness of that watershed and the Taku in general. It's an amazing place, and we owe the Taku River Tlingit a debt of gratitude for their wonderful stewardship of that watershed. It's still a huge salmon producer. It has its issues, but it's got an amazing abundance of salmon that we all benefit from. You know, I'm here in Seattle. I can buy fish from that river and eat it. And when you're up in the air, you look around and you just see all this intact, beautiful habitat, and then people on the land reconnecting. It's really stressed to me how important it is for people to be connected to their land. Mm-hmm. And we were recently out on one of the TRT camps on the Inkland and Nackinac rivers, where they come together and form the main stem Taku. And we were out gill netting for salmon that is going back to the community. And it was just I don't know how to describe it. It was just a wonderful feeling. It's such a hard place to get to without either a days long bushwhack or a helicopter ride that costs a lot of money. And you can just see the joy in people's faces and hearts when they get to be there and just be present. And I really feel that too. And I feel extremely lucky to just be a part of that and not just do the science and collect interesting data, but to actually have sincere connections with people and kind of watch them do their thing. Right. It's awesome. I have a hard time explaining it. I get emotional about it because there just aren't many places left in the world where you get to experience that. And it's just a really, really special watershed.
Awesome. I know we talk a lot here on the Skeena too. It's like, you know, salmon has often been a unifier and helped bridge divides and build connections to where we sometimes have had to stop, you know, have had to join together to stop some, you know, potentially destructive projects, from tar sands pipelines to fish farms to liquefaction plants right at the Skeena Estuary. And, you know, but there's definite concerns that with, you know, the multiple stress factors on salmon and reduced populations, that, you know, the less people get to interact and still connect with salmon, the harder it is then for that drive to fight to protect it, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've really been struck by salmon are a part of the family, right? Like, they're community builders, and, you know, they're right there at the dinner table. They're just such an important thing. And I feel it here, living in Washington, where I see Columbia River dams and the crazy engineering we do just to pass salmon up 7 or 8 dams to get home and spawn. It's really become a complicated, convoluted process down here. I'm glad there's still places further north where we don't have to have that. And I hope we don't.
What's a part of your researcher job that nobody sees or that you don't get to share very often that you'd want people to know about?
I think I always think about the fact as a scientist, kind of your front-facing products are what you've written, right? Like either whether it's kind of a stodgy scientific article or maybe an opinion piece. And if you were to Google my name, that's what you see, right? The things I've written. And what I think, and I love writing and I love having those products and I think they're important. But what I think people don't see is behind the scenes, the relationship building it takes to be a good and effective scientist and try to apply your work, not just to advancing scientific knowledge, but to helping others and complementing other people's knowledge and really contributing to community. And so the phone calls, the Zoom meetings, the time on the river, smiling and, you know, talking about the beautiful scenery and what we're going to have for dinner, all those things really contribute, I think, to being a good and effective scientist. And it's the things you won't get from reading a paper. And so, I really enjoy that side of it. And I get to talk to people like you and interact with people who have much different views than me. And I really value all of that and think it's super important.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Chris, and for all the work that you do to help protect our salmon watersheds.
Thanks for having me, Nikki. It was a lot of fun chatting with you. I appreciate it.
I have had the good fortune of visiting Atlin, BC, home of the Taku River Tlingit First Nation. It is a remote and stunning part of the world. The Taku River Tlingit First Nation have been stewarding their territory that now includes what is known as northwestern British Columbia into the Yukon further north and westward into the state of Alaska. Their conservation and connection to wild salmon rivers are helping ensure resilient populations into the future. We are grateful for all that they and their collaborators are doing to try to keep this a salmon stronghold for generations to come. Thank you so much for listening to this 54 Degrees North podcast as part of our Salmon Connections and Resilience series. This episode was recorded from the unceded territory of the Wet'suwet'en Nation between August and October 2022. Thanks so much to Mark Connor and Chris Sargent for the interviews. Thanks to Talpa Ted Turner for the music and Facundo Gastia Zorro for the artwork. This podcast was produced by Nikki Skuse with production and editing assistant by Namita Prakash, thanks to the Canada Summer Jobs Program. The 54 Degrees North podcast is available for download on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts.